You are listening to a sermon by John Neufeld, recorded on Sunday, June 21, 2009, at the Point Grey Intermennonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only, and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
What was the part of the passage of Scripture that you read that struck most of us? What struck you?
The last phrase.
The last phrase? And what was that?
The builder will be saved, but only if he has to repent.
Okay. Okay, what else struck people?
The famous verse is number 11.
Yes, the famous verse. Did you know that was one of Menno Simon's favorite verses? No other foundation. And it has been hung on many a wall as a model, in homes and in churches, and left hanging there. Now, in working with texts, we are often told, well, don't overlook the obvious. And this is the obvious thing that we should speak about, but I'm not going to speak about it, I'm going to ignore it. And I want to treat 1 Corinthians 3:11, those familiar words, as an egg, and I want to deal with the nest. And I approach this passage. Oh, by the way, Henry, how come you didn't get my directions right? I had asked for up to verse 17, I think.
I have no idea.
No.
It's Andre's fault, he does the bullets.
Yeah. Well, I'll refer to something out of verse 16 or 17. I want to approach this passage with an expression of Walter Brueggemann's as my guide. Well, actually, it's not Brueggemann's expression. He borrowed it from Walt Whitman. Whitman wrote, "After the seas are all crossed, as they seem already crossed, and after the great captains and engineers have accomplished their work, and after the noble inventors, after the scientists, the chemists, the geologists, ethnologists, finally shall come the poet, worthy of that name. The true Son of God shall come singing his songs." Brueggemann wrote a helpful little book entitled Finally Comes the Poet. And what he writes about in his introductory chapter is that speech in industrialized worlds has become reductionist. And he says, "The gospel is widely held but greatly reduced. It is truth that is flattened, trivialized, and rendered inane." And he didn't give the example, but the example of reductionist spirituality that I thought of was the four spiritual laws. You've heard of them?
Yes.
In four short statements, the attempt has been made to condense the mystery of God and God's relationship to humanity and the role of Jesus into four short sentences. And that's an impossibility. It doesn't work. He says our technical way of thinking reduces mystery to problem and transforms assurance into certitude and revises quality into quantity and takes the categories of biblical faith and represents them in manageable shapes. And he hopes that in the church we would have something more profound, more mysterious, and more challenging than what he calls a prose-flattened world. And when he pleads for poetic speech, he does not mean rhyme or rhythm or meter, but language that moves. Like Bob Gibson's fastball that jumps at the last moment and that breaks open old worlds and with surprise, abrasion, and pace. So poetry, poetic speech, is not rhyme, rhythm, and meter, but it's speech which will invite us to think more than what is said. It teases us to explore and to ponder. Now, you've all heard the term or the expression, Jesus came to save sinners. And that doesn't turn our cranks too much because we've heard that for decades. But I came across a book title just some months ago by Robert Bell. And the title was, Jesus Wants to Save Christians. I took notice. It was an out of the ordinary way of saying something. So the power of poetry is shattering evocative speech that breaks fixed conclusions and presses us always toward new, dangerous, and imaginative possibilities. So in such kind of poetic speech, Brueggemann says, a familiar text is permitted to have a fresh hearing, a second opinion. And it's the artistic moment in which words that are concrete remain open, close to our life, but moving out to new angles of reality. And he uses the phrase, possibility overwhelms the necessity of my life. Now, in Corinthians, Paul uses many words of explanation to analyze, to correct, to admonish, but he also does something else, and he does it in these paragraphs that we have as a text. He slips in a few evocative words, words that invite us to slow down, to ponder, to reflect, to put them aside and come back the next day or the next week, and to allow our imagination to play with the possibilities inherent in expressions which in the text are devoid of explanation. He does not say, when he says in our text, you are God's field, or God's building, or in the part which was omitted, God's temple, he does not explain what he means by any of those expressions. He just plunks them out there for us. Now, reading carefully honed definitions in an essay or in a dictionary doesn't provide a thrill for most of us, because our imagination is not thrilled and stirred by definition. But if we play around with an image, we can achieve something and experience something. Now, I've come to Corinth many times in my life. Not really, of course, but I've been living in Corinth in the letters and in the conversation between Paul and Corinth for 40-some years. And this winter, from January to May, I was teaching a group of seniors a course in 1 Corinthians in one of the churches in Winnipeg, Wednesday mornings for seniors. And I have appreciated afresh the power of these three images in this paragraph. So after a glowing introduction, first 9 verses, he gets down to the business at hand and deals with squabbles in church. He analyzes their situation, tells them straight out that they are immature, unable to handle solid food, but in spite of his reservations about their spiritual maturity, he raises the bar and gives them a dose of imaginative, provocative thinking. He affirms the one foundation, Jesus Christ, and then he slips into this prophetic, poetic mode and uses three images in a matter of seconds. You are God's field. You are God's building. You are God's temple. And the you, in distinction from the second last hymn we sang, does not mean the individual you. The you is you as a group, as a body of believers, are God's field, God's building, God's temple. So let's play around with each of these images a bit. You are God's field. He's writing to an urban setting, Corinth. He's been there 18 months. He's walked around the city, and he's probably noticed that behind many a home is a little garden plot. He's not thinking of a prairie section of land. He says to the church, you are God's field. Think about what that might mean. Now, as I thought about that these last few months, I thought of two of our old friends in Winnipeg. I mean, they're in their upper 80s. Two women who've been single all their lives, professional women, now retired, live in their own home, and they have one fantastic garden near Polo Park behind their house. And we go there once or twice in summer, get some sorrel for them for cooking, and some tomatoes, huge tomatoes. And we admire the garden that these two ladies have tended. So here's where I get some of my thinking about what Paul might have had in mind. There's one soil here, there's one sun, and there's the same rain, and yet there's this incredible variety growing. I wouldn't want to visit a garden plot at the Weeb Sisters, which is only cucumbers. They have cucumbers and peas and carrots and tomatoes and all kinds of flowers and cabbage. And the garden image suggests to me that there's been a time of soil preparation. There's been seeding, there's been planting, there's been growth, there's been a great deal of variety, and even some weeds. And Paul is suggesting to his group of people who are divided, who can't tolerate differences between each other, think of yourselves as God's garden in which variety is flourishing. And the cukes are affirmed, and so are the tomatoes, and so are the beautiful flowers. And remember that Paul says, this garden does not belong to Paul or Apollos or Cephas. It's God's. No leader in the church is in charge of this garden. The garden is God's. So those are some things I think of when I think of the garden. He says, you are God's building. Now, this was a house fellowship, not a church with a church building. And the thought that came to me was that behind the building, there is an architect. And architects leave their imprint on their work, don't they? Just as an artist does. We have three churches that I can think of in Manitoba, and whenever we come past any of them, the thought crosses my mind, this is one of Harold Funk's churches. Harold Funk grew up in Abbotsford, became an architect and settled in Winnipeg. Bethel Church, Steinbeck Mennonite, and Emmanuel Pentecostal. The style is there. This is Harold. At CNBC, we had an old chapel built in the 70s. And before that chapel was built, a different architect, Rudy Friesen, came and sat with the faculty and the board members and the building committee. He said, what do you want to express through this chapel building? And then he would come back with some sketches. In the end, one of the sets of drawings was accepted. And if you've been in that chapel, rough beams, unhewn beams, crisscrossing the ceiling, girders visible. And we asked, what is this all about? Well, he says, I think that what I'm trying to visualize here is the raw strength, the sturdiness of the Mennonite faith and the Mennonite tradition. And that's what I'm trying to express in the building. Or in Winnipeg now, we have the hydro building downtown. Geothermal heating for all of its 20-some stories. Recirculating air. It's the most greenest place architecturally, environmentally. So the imprint of the architect and the purpose for the building is evident. Now, when Paul talks about a church being God's building, he's not talking about a building, but he's talking about people as building. And it raises the question for me, okay, what imprint would God want to leave on his people building as a witness to the world? Since God is the architect. Another thing about building is that some parts of the building are hidden, invisible to the eye, underground, piles and all that. And others are open to observation and points of discussion. But all aspects of the building are integrated and interrelated as a system. And so for some people, the image of the building as representing the people of God could be something that triggers their imagination, depending on what we bring to this image. The third one is that you are God's temple. Now, the Corinthians knew about temples. There were lots of them. Archaeologists have unearthed some. The remains of one are estimated to have been 175 feet long and 75 feet wide, and had many supporting pillars, each with of 6 feet diameter, and six of these are still standing. So the Corinthians knew about temples. And this is probably what their first idea would be when they hear Paul say, you are God's temple. But probably Paul wasn't thinking about the Corinthian temple. For when Paul was writing, the Jerusalem temple was still intact. It was destroyed in 70 AD. And what we have to get at, I think, in order to explore this image, is that Paul knew what the temple in Jerusalem symbolized for Judah, for Israel. But the image, the meaning of temple began to change with Jesus. Remember the conversation with the Samaritan woman before they got into the subject of her husbands. The woman had posed a theological question. Which is the right place to worship? Samaria or Jerusalem? And Jesus told her the time is coming when you will worship the Father neither on this mountain, Samaria, nor in Jerusalem. The time has now come when true worshippers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth, since God is spirit. So is Paul saying here that this is now really the case? God's presence previously thought to be in a special place has been replaced by presence in among a group of gathered people. Forget about cement and girders and spires. Forget about being green and geothermal. Because it's not a place, it's people. And God is uniquely present where people gather and focus on what Jesus has been about. So the temple as building is no longer the image about God's presence. God's home address is no longer Jerusalem or at a certain intersection in any city. God's address becomes there where a group of people gather in God's name. There God is present. And that's enough to blow the Corinthian mind, and it's probably enough to blow many a mind in our time. So what else, you know, you see, each of these images creates thoughts in each person's mind, I believe. So each of them opens the window of the imagination, inviting reflection, not in any prescribed way, no particular end in sight. Just ponder each one. That's what these three images invite us to do. And if we like it, we can actually talk about what thoughts we had about these images in our coffee time and in the response time, because after all, we are the people who, as a group of believers, are actually God's garden and God's building and God's temple.